This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello, and thanks for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Fiona Stalker. This midweek podcast is dedicated to climbing legend Sir Chris Bonington. I interviewed him earlier this year for BBC Radio Scotland's Out for the Weekend programme, just as a new film about his life was released called Bonington Mountaineer, as well as his autobiography Ascent. Both offer a very moving and stark account of his sometimes tragic life in the mountains and his deep personal loss. He describes some of those moments in the interview you're just about to hear. We begin hearing about his remarkable ascent of the Old Man of Hoy on Orkney at the age of 80.
Well, of course, I made the first ascent with Tom Pate and Rusty Bailey back in 1957, and I'd never been back. And it was Leo Holding, who is a good friend, one of our most brilliant climbers, and he actually happened to be the youngest person ever to have climbed it, because his dad took him up it when he was 11. And it was Leo's idea. We've climbed together in the past. And he said, well, look, let's go and do it when you're 80. And I put him off at that stage, primarily because Wendy, of course, was desperately ill. She had motor neuron disease. And I wasn't able to do anything at all, really, during that. And then sadly, she died in July of 2014. And Leo just said, well, look, do you want to come and do it? He was thinking if it might take my mind off grief, which it did. And it was a kind of it was a useful kind of catharsis to go and do it. But I found it very challenging.
It's interesting because I've spoken before to Sir Ranulph Fiennes, who lost his wife after a long illness. He said that his grief was profound, and what took him out of it finally was a decision to climb the Eiger. In what way did you find that it helped you, Chris?
Well, I mean, I love climbing, and I love the whole process of climbing. Mm-hmm. So to me, even though, yes, you have some hard times at times when you are climbing, it's primarily a joyful kind of process. Funnily enough, there was a kind of repetition even from the first ascent, because when we climbed the Old Man of Hoy in 1966, I just got back from Ecuador because my first son, Conrad, had lost his life in an accident in Scotland. And the grief of that, of course, is intense. And Tom Patey, who of course comes from Aberdeen, is one of the greatest climbers that Scotland's ever produced, and a very close friend. Mm. And I think he asked me whether I'd like to go and try to climb the Old Man of Hoy, which was unclimbed at the time, with the same kind of motive as Leo had as well. And it was, once again, it was a kind of catharsis that when you're climbing, you can't think of anything else except that bit of rock in front of you. And it therefore acts as a kind of a temporary soothing kind of process. And it helped me then when I made the first ascent. And it helped me immensely when I went and did it with Leo. And it was a combination, I think, of the climb itself and climbing with good friends, basically.
And when you got to the top of the Old Man of Hoy, an incredible feat in itself, but also you were doing it almost five decades after you first did it. It must have been an overwhelming emotions when you got to the top.
It was a very emotional moment, without a shadow of doubt. And I mean, getting up, I'd actually kind of pulled my back a bit anyway. I was very unfit, so it was a real struggle to climb it, and yet I managed to climb it as opposed to being hauled up it. But every single move hurt, and I was doing a lot of damage to my back. I had two slipped discs from doing the climb and trapped nerves in my back and all kind of things. And I'm still having trouble with it today, but, it was worth it.
So why did you decide to write Ascent now? I mean, you've been writing, obviously, for a long time, Chris, but why did you decide? Because, I mean, it's really, it's very honest, it's very moving, very personal account.
Well, the initial thing that I think this probably applies to practically every author there is because a publisher approached me. And of course, I'd written about 17 books, and three of them were kind of climbing autobiographies. So I'd done it before. But at the same time, I could see the sense of it, that writing a full book where you actually look at the whole picture and also kind of, I think, go deeper into your own personal life and how it links with everything else did appeal to me. So I embarked on it cheerfully and then found it very, very challenging.
I was going to say, some of it's so honest and it lays bare some very traumatic moments as well in personal life and climbing life. It must have been very hard at some points.
I think it was emotionally hard, but I think at the same time, I found it helped me get some of those things kind of out of my system. And I think particularly writing about Wendy and Wendy's illness, but also writing about, well, Conrad's death, and writing and coming to grips with the loss of friends as well. And how do you justify it? And of course, to a degree, there's no justification. It's just something you love doing, you are addicted to, if you like. Writing it, I did. I found hugely challenging, but at the same time, I'm very glad I did it.
You lost a huge amount of friends, some of them right before your eyes. Why did you keep doing it? Why did you keep going back, having seen so much tragedy in your time?
I mean, I love climbing so much, and the love of that climbing, it's not a macabre love. It's a joyous love in every kind of way. I love the sensation of climbing. I love the beauty of the mountains. I love the environment in which I am climbing. And I love the friends with whom I climb. So that it's something that is at the core, if you like, of my life. And I think it's at the core, if you like, of all committed adventurers' lives. Because, you know, you could have the same challenge, if you like, the same question that you can't answer to all my fellow climbers, whether it's Doug Scott or Leo Holding or what have you. It's the actual danger of it is the thing that attracts you. There's no doubt about that. But at the same time, the justification of actually going on doing it when you've got a wife whom you love, you've got children whom you love, and yes, it is irresponsible perhaps, but it's something that you love so much you just couldn't stop doing it.
If we can go back to beginnings a bit more, and you talk through your book about life-changing moments, and there was a life-changing moment, as you call it, when I suppose you were young and you realised that conventional sports were just not you, but you find climbing. Tell me about that.
Well, I wouldn't say no conventions. Funnily enough, conventional sports, I'm not a good sports person, but funnily enough, at school, because I went to a day school in Hampstead, and at first, I was quite a timid child, and I hated rugby, and I was frightened of it. And I kept on, you know, jumping games periods and things like that until I was put on report. So you had to actually go to the school teacher and get it ticked off that you'd actually not just been there to play, but you'd done your best. And that made me actually kind of fling myself into it. And suddenly I found myself thoroughly enjoying it. And I ended up as captain of the school third 15. And the third 15, you know, was the people who were very enthusiastic but not much good. But so that, you know, I had actually got pleasure out of that. I loved gym. I'm not a gymnastic genius, but I just thoroughly enjoyed it. I think I had a much stronger sense of wanting to get out into the wilds. And even before I'd ever discovered climbing, I'd wander off on my own in the hills when I was on holiday and so on. The discovery actually of rock climbing was something that, was huge and cathartic. And I suddenly realised that this is something that, A, I was just naturally good at, and B, I just loved doing. And from the very first time I touched rock in that kind of way and tied a rope around my waist, I knew I'd discovered the thing I loved.
There's a wonderful picture of you at the front of your book, just as you open it in the cover, with the most amazing climbing gear on, nothing that we would recognise now. Describe to me what you wore when you were climbing when you first started out.
When I started climbing, the first climb was 1951. And in 1951, the basic climbing gear was actually not just the kind of stuff they were wearing before the Second World War. It's almost the kind of stuff you were wearing at the beginning of the century. I mean, I had a pair of gym shoes, specialised climbing shoes had never been discovered. And the best kind of gym shoes were actually the cheapest Woolworths gym shoes because they had, the important thing is they had rubber soles. Mm-hmm. And they were very, very tight, so they clung
Perfect.
To your feet. I had a hemp rope, which was a second-hand hemp rope, and I think it was even questionable whether it would hold your own weight, let alone a falling body. And you just had a few kind of rope slings around your neck, and your only protection when you were climbing, you would actually find a knobble of rock that you could actually balance one of these slings on top of, or you'd find a stone jammed in a crack and you'd loop it round. Whereas, of course, today you've got climbing harnesses, you've got super sticky rubber shoes, you've got a whole array of camming devices and everything else. And I use them all. But at that time, I mean, what I was using was what you use. So you took it for granted and you said, well, that's what you have for when you go climbing.
And did you have climbing heroes when you were climbing as a youth? Were there people, and probably I'm guessing men at this time were much more high profile. Did you have heroes that you looked up to?
Oh, yes. The most influential book that I read in my early climbing days was Mountaineering in Scotland by W.H. Murray. It's a wonderful book. And he wrote that, in fact, during the war. He's a prisoner of war during the war. And apparently he wrote it on toilet paper as a prisoner of war. And so he was a leading kind of Scottish pioneer of the immediate pre-war period. And so all of these were stories of climbs in the Highlands before the war. And to me, what was important was that this was something that I could aspire to. I could hitchhike up to Scotland, which I did, and then go and repeat those routes and do them. So that I wasn't interested in climbing about the Himalayas, because that was unattainable. I was interested in what I could actually do myself. So that was my first great influence, if you like, and he is my first hero. My ambitions, if you like, were always to what I could actually feel that I could reach at the time and focus on, rather than, for instance, having the dream of climbing Everest before you'd ever left the country.
There's a very interesting book, a part in the book where you talk about, again, you've encountered some tragedy and death on an Everest exhibition, and you promise Wendy that you're not going to do it again. But then you need to go back, don't you? And you do go back. That was very interesting. And what made you change your mind, and how did Wendy take it?
Well, I didn't quite promise. I didn't know. It was after the 82 Everest expedition, when we'd gone, and in a way, I mean, what leads up to that is that in 75 it was the biggest expedition that had ever left Britain, and we almost proved in the Southwest Face expedition that if you marshal enough resources, you plan it sufficiently well, you can climb almost anything. So it's in a way the appeal is to try to do it with less.
Yeah.
And when we went back in 82, instead of having 18 climbers, 60 altitude porters and God knows what, there were just going to be six of us. And of those six, only four of us were actually going to go onto the route, and the two others were just going to stay at Advanced Base Camp. So we were reducing it to the absolute minimum, and we were trying to climb the unclimbed northeast ridge of Everest. And it proved a huge challenge, and I think we all began to wonder whether we'd bitten off more than we could chew, but nobody actually admitted it. And it was one of the most focused, greatest experiences I've ever had, even though it ended in tragedy. And then finally, one member of the team, Dick Renshaw, had in effect a heart attack, and we had to get him down. I was tired. Peter Borman and Joe Tasker made one last attempt on climbing the unclimbed section to join the ridge where the traditional north ridge route goes up. And I thought they'd do it. Tragically, they didn't, and they never got to the end, and one Peter's body has been found. But at the end of that, yeah, I was profoundly distressed. We were very close. And at that point, I didn't think I'd ever go back to Everest. And I told Wendy that. And then, of course, you know, inevitably, very quickly after that, the possibilities came. Arne Næss, Norwegian climber, millionaire, who wanted to lead the first ever and finance first ever Norwegian expedition to climb Everest. And he invited me to go along so that I could help with all the logistics and the planning. And at first I said, no, I won't go because I've told Wendy I wouldn't go. And he just said, well, do you mind if I, you know, ask your advice from time to time?
Reeling you in.
I said, yes, oh, absolutely, as a fly fisherman. And
he knew
he had a very willing kind of salmon at the end of the line. And so I just couldn't resist it. And he'd be phoning me up and I'd be in my little office in our cottage in the Lake District. And inevitably, you know, Wendy happened to come into the office when I was in deep conversation about planning. And it was quite obvious that I was going on the mountain. But she was upset, not because I was going back. She thought I always would. But the fact that I hadn't discussed it with her. Mm. And she was absolutely right. But she then, you know, was 100% behind me.
As you describe her, she's a very strong woman because often, or certainly several times, she had to deliver the bad news, didn't she, to the families of some of your friends who'd not made it back alive.
She was a very gentle person, quite a shy person, but under that gentleness and shyness, yeah, there's huge strength and huge compassion. And we, of course, we were very, very close to those families. They were close friends, and we were close family friends. Our children were all about the same age and things like that. So it was all too often there'd be Wendy that'd be going and both breaking the news and then giving what support she possibly could.
You did a series about adventurers some time ago where you interviewed and spoke to and spent some time with some incredible adventurers like yourself around the world. Did you find that there was a common theme, a common thread, similar motivations?
Oh, there was, without a shadow of doubt. I think the common thread was the people I wanted to talk to were people who were the cutting edge of post-war innovative adventure. So John Hunt, leader of the Everest expedition, Maurice Herzog, who led the French Everest expedition, Reinhold Messner, one of the greatest climbers of all time, and then the sailors, of course, Robin Knox Johnson, first man to sail around the world single-handed.
Who you became
so
quite friendly with, haven't you?
And I've become, yeah, he's become a very good friend and we've done a lot together. So the common theme is firstly that I think being attracted to risk. Adventure is risk. Adventure is dealing with uncertainty and dealing with the unknown. There's also, I think, a love and respect for the natural environment, wherever you happen to be. Mm. And whether they're sailors or Arctic explorers or what have you, they can be very different individuals, but they have those things definitely in common. And I thought the most interesting one, I felt I had to put in the first landing on the moon, because that is, if you like, one of the great fundamental adventures. Whereas the adventurer, be it a sailor or whatever, has actually chosen to go on that adventure and has actually created the adventure him or herself. The astronauts basically were recruited and were part of an incredibly structured kind of organisation to get them there. And when I went to see Neil Armstrong, and he'd retired by that time, of course, and he was in Lebanon, Ohio, which is a kind of quiet little town in Ohio, and his office was on the main street just above an estate agent's. And as I went into his office, I felt I was going into a kind of a local businessman's office, and he's a very quiet-spoken man. I said, gosh, what have we got in common? And then he started talking, particularly he'd come into the astronaut program through the US Air Force, and he was a test pilot, and he'd been taking the rocket planes, which were in a way were a precursor to the orbiting vehicles. Mm. And these rocket planes were going out into the outer atmosphere and seeing how far they could go. And he was describing the fascination of taking these vehicles and taking this machine and himself and touching, getting as close to the envelope of the possibilities you possibly could. And I suddenly realised we were talking the same language.
Yeah. Pushing all the time, pushing the boundaries.
Right. Yes, totally.
What's your best memory of climbing in Scotland? Because it's somewhere obviously you're very passionate about, you spent time in, you've met friends here. What was your favourite?
I think one of the things I've always remembered, and it was a very special day, it was my second holiday in Scotland. I was still at school, and what I'd do is I'd hitchhike up to Scotland, and I hitchhiked up with another guy who was a bit older than me. He was at university, and I was still at school. And we were going to wander around the Northern Highlands, so we had a great big rucksack each. And we went right up into Sutherland. We'd spent a couple of nights by Lochasint, and by Lochasint in Sutherland, there's a little promontory, and it's Ardvreck Castle, completely ruined little Scottish castle, but it had a little bit of a kind of an open cellar. We were bivouacking in that. And then the day we'd chosen, we were going to, from there, we hitchhiked to Loch Inver, and we wanted to climb Sulven, but we were going to do a rock climb on Sulven, and Sulven's, it's quite a long walk from Loch Inver actually to the mountain. And it's a great whale back of a mountain that rises. It's a sandstone peak, and it sits on a granite kind of platform. So you're going through these roly, peating land, and as you're approaching it, it's a long whale back, but you go and approach its front, it looks like a wonderful peak, and there's a big buttress of rock that leads to the summit. So we left our rucksacks at the bottom of it, and then we picked our way climbing with the basic gear you had in those days. I think by that time I got a nylon rope and you got a few slings, and we lost the route, and so we did a new route up it and got to the top, traversed the mountain, and the view from the top of Sulven is absolutely magnificent. And from the top, if you look south, you're looking towards Stack Polly, which is about 10-12 miles away, across Loch Shanastack Skag, which is this wide, shallow loch with little islands. And what we were planning to do was walk along its bank. So we traversed it, got back to our rucksacks, picked them up, and then we walked along. There's no paths at that time at all. And it was about 3 o'clock in the morning that we finally reached the foot of Stack Polly, found a little bothy to spend the night in. That is what, to me, walking, adventure, climbing is all about. It's a sense of mystery, it's a sense of beauty, it's a sense of expansiveness. I've remembered that day till this very day.
Since we're in reflective mode then, Chris, looking back, what would you say you're most proud of?
It's difficult to say, actually. I think in a climbing sense, I suppose the Southwest Face of Everest was a huge kind of challenge, administrative problem, leadership challenge, and everything else. And putting the whole thing together and then leading it successfully, I think that's probably the thing that I'm most proud of. I think the thing that I've enjoyed the most is probably there's something completely different. And it was where there's just been two of us, and a great friend of mine, a guy called Jim Fotheringham, who's our local dentist, and we've climbed together an awful lot. And we went and climbed a peak called Shiveling, which is comparatively small. It's 6,300 metres high. It was unclimbed. But we climbed it what's called alpine style, where you just arrive at the bottom and you pack a rucksack and keep going till you get to the top. And it was 5 bivouacs up. It was completely kind of fresh and unknown, even to the degree that our original objective was different, and we realised that was much too difficult and much too big. So we just changed our minds. So we'll go and try to do this one. And that in its wonderful simplicity and commitment was to me the best of climbing is. But, you know, what you're proud of, I think it's more of how much you enjoyed it that really matters.
And you're an absolutely wonderful storyteller, Chris. I'm just lost in your stories. Just finally then, I've got to ask you, Old Man of Hoy. Are you going to do it again? 90?
I don't think so, somehow. No, I've got that.
You've done that, ticked off.
I think I've done that. I think what I do want to do is, there's no doubt about it, as you get older, and I noticed as I got way into my 70s, your climbing standard does drop down, and what you lose is that you've stiffened up so much and you haven't got the same kind of strength, that instead of just drifting up climbs, which has a wonderful kind of sensual kind of satisfaction, you creak up them. And I still want to get back into climbing. In fact, yesterday afternoon we went onto the Westway climbing wall in London.
Oh, good.
And I'm finding that actually gets me moving again. I still want to get back into the mountains. I enjoy walking, I think, every bit as much as I do climbing. And I'm lucky as well, having found love once again. And you suddenly realise that, life is very, very definable. And so I want to make the most of life in every kind of way, but particularly walking and wandering in the hills. And, going trekking in the Himalayas and maybe having a really nice, dead easy, little unclimbed peak at the end of a trek, which I can go and climb.
The legend, that is Sir Chris Bonington. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. If so, please rate us and leave a review. That helps others find us and enjoy this podcast too. Mark and Ewan will be back on Saturday with the next edition of the Scotland Outdoors podcast. If you've enjoyed listening to me, then search for my regular Friday afternoon show Out for the Weekend on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Fiona Stalker. Thanks for listening.